podcast this week. Halloween ends yet again. That's right, folks. Halloween ends for the umpteenth time. And if that has caused you trauma, then we have the perfect person to discuss that with. Jamie Lee Curtis, the star of Halloween Ends. Plus, he is the Invisible Man, but he's also the star of Emily Oliver Jackson Cohen. All that and more on the movie podcast that... Wait a second. No. Can you guys hear that?
What?
Can you hear that?
Two more weeks to Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Two more weeks to Halloween, Empire Podcast. Two more weeks to Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Two more weeks to Halloween, Empire Podcast.
Oh, yes, folks. That's right. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. 2 more weeks until Halloween.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Two weeks
until Halloween. I am so excited. Have you ordered your skeletons already? Are you prepared? What have you done? Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. I am joined by my three colleagues. I'm so excited about Halloween. I've forgotten how to post a podcast. I'm joined by my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Helen O'Hara is here, Geek Queen.
Hello, I have already bought 2 Halloween outfits for my very small, cute niece. So I'm ready.
But why 2? Are there 2 of her?
Because I couldn't choose.
Ah,
she's just going to have to do multiple changes through the day like an award show host.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
That seems reasonable.
One is a witch costume, which admittedly has Peppa Pig on the front.
Which is which?
Other one is a Wonder Woman costume, obviously.
Wonder Woman! Which one? Gal Gadot Wonder Woman or Linda Carter Wonder Woman?
I mean, kind of comics, semi-accurate Wonder Woman,
okay.
I would say.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
All right. We are also joined by our great big fucking nerd, James Dyer. James, are you prepared? Are you filled with the Halloween spirit?
Stop it.
Absolutely not. In fact, I loathe Halloween. And the thing that annoys me most about Halloween is when people do not respect the fundamental rules of Halloween, which is that if you don't have a pumpkin or a cobweb or a spider or some other tat in your house, fuck off.
All right. So you don't have treats for the kiddies on Halloween?
100% not. No.
He just sits with a giant bowl full of candy inside.
A little
and just
bit.
Eats it all.
I used to do this. I used to go out and get like a big box of sweets just on the off chance that one of the little shits didn't take a hint and actually knocked on the door anyway. Because the way I figure it, like, it's just a glorified mugging. They're coming out saying, give me something or I will fuck your shit up. Like, that's basically what they're saying. So I didn't want to get mugged. So I would have sweets there in case of emergency, in case some fucking feral teenager just turned up and demanded candy on pain of death. And then I'd give them some and hope they went away. But then, of course, the bonus of that is if none of them do turn up when I've turned off all the lights and the TV and sat in darkness pretending not to be home, then I have a big bowl of sweets to eat the next day.
It's
so,
a win-win.
So it is a win-win.
So
it
James win-win. Passes out November 1st. He's just in a sugar coma on his sofa.
Average one day, to be honest.
Yeah, average. Yeah, indeed. And Halloween is on a Monday this year. Amon Warman is here, best dressed film journalist in the... Of this part of the room. No, you're very well dressed, Amon. How well dressed are you going to be on All Hallows Eve?
I'm going to be very well dressed, but not in any Halloween gear. I've never celebrated Halloween.
Remember, nudity is not dressed.
Why not?
We've discussed this.
My family...
Is this you being a scaredy cat again?
Well, it's partially that, but also my family were just never into it. My mum especially, growing up, just like, it wasn't going to happen. So, yeah, I just never really felt the need to... celebrate it. Although the candy that James speaks of does sound very appealing.
By the way, can we just stop calling it fucking candy? This is not an American
sweeties.
Sweeties.
Come on.
Yeah, big fan of the sweeties, of the chocolates, all the rest of it. But yeah, I'm just not a fan of the spirit of the season.
On one occasion did I take part in the Halloween spirit. And this is that I went, and I'll show you the picture now here. This is me as the crow.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I donned the face paint and a wig, obviously, and all of that. And I dressed up as the crow and I went out in Boreham Wood and tried not to get killed.
Right.
On Halloween many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And that's the only time I've ever done it.
Try not to get killed. I mean, you have a very skewed vision of what happens on Halloween.
Well, it's Boreham Wood, you know, so it's actually quite dodgy. But my old martial arts teacher used to live there, and he insisted that we got 2 options. We went round to his house. And we had 2 options. We could either go trick-or-treating, and I was like, hard passed. He said, or we all just rock up down to the pub in central Boreham Wood, dress like this and see what happens. And I was just like, I don't want to do either of these things, but I figure, like, given the company I'm in, I should be okay. So it was fine.
Well, Great anecdote.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Hansel.
Fantastic anecdote.
It was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, did you leave me a cutting point? Are we watching any films for Halloween this year? Do we have any Halloween movie plans?
Well, obviously, we already watched Hocus Pocus 2 for the first time. So, you know, we've got that in store.
That is a big revisit.
And we will, of course, be talking about Halloween Ends. Mm-hmm.
Some of us will. I have not seen any, full disclosure, I have not seen any films this week.
I'm shocked and appalled.
Due to a combination of COVID and just fragrant? I smell great when I'm doing it. Unprofessionalism. Yeah. Flagrant unprofessional.
I'm very disappointed in you.
What's your excuse, Jimbo?
Well, we'll get on to that. I'm a conscientious objector from this week's film review section, as we will discover.
Mm. To one film.
Yeah.
To one film. Yeah.
I made a moral stand.
Against one film.
Yeah. That you hadn't seen.
Yeah, that's right. I've taken a very principled stance on something I have no experience of. This is going to be a fun conversation.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, we've got two more weeks of Halloween. Ding, 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 ding,
ding, ding.
So we'll get into Halloween movies and what we're watching in Halloween and all that sort of stuff over the next couple of weeks. But for the time being, let's get into the regular pod, shall we? And let's start with a question. Let's have a question. And the question this week comes from at Fertility Fun, who slid into my DMs to say Angela Lansbury has died. That's not how I found out, by the way. Truly a loss for stage and screen. And Fertility Fun goes on to ask, best film use of a teapot and or typewriter? And I don't like the teapot part of that question, so I've changed it to typewriter.
Wow.
So, and I've widened it. I've expanded it to typewriter and keyboard. So the best use in a film of a typewriter and or a keyboard. Now, I will say.
Yes.
Fertility Fun says the best two typewriter uses are both in Atonement. The C-U-N-T typing completely shocked me. Yeah. And I love the typewriter sound on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If we're talking typewriter sounds on soundtracks, it's 9 to 5.
However, like me. You're like, you know, but instead of Event Horizon, you work 9 to 5 into every single one of your answers to these questions.
Twice recently, okay? Twice. But because it is one of the great songs. But
it is one of the great songs.
It is one of the great songs. Just in case anyone is wondering, there might be somebody out there who is young and doesn't know. The reason we're talking about typewriters in relation to Angela Lansbury is because that was the sort of the opening sequence of Murder, She Wrote, which was her great TV show. The weird thing is, of course, like that's just one stage of her career, which was astonishing. Like she did everything. She got an Oscar nomination for her very first film role in Gaslight, for God's sake.
I don't believe you.
No, it's true. And then just went from strength from there. She was in a, you know, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. She was at one point an exercise guru.
Really?
Bonnie
Langford?
A little bit more gentle and slow.
Bonnie Langford also got a nomination for Gaslight.
That's true. You should look it up.
You should totally look it up.
So, it was basically in her Murder, She Wrote years. She was like, she had an exercise sort of tape for ladies. I've listened
to
a podcast
about it. But everyone kept
dying on it. It was just very sweet, kind of gentle, like, oh, if you can't handle this, do it this way. If you can't manage, you know,
what
full set up, just try a bit.
Like drinking a cup of tea.
I mean, it wasn't far off that, but it was just lovely and encouraging and gentle and very nice. As you would expect of Angela Lansbury, who nobody had a bad word to say about her. She famously supported loads of AIDS victims during the AIDS epidemic before it was fashionable to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I heard the story, the Charles Manson story. Did you guys see this on Twitter?
Yes, I heard this.
Yeah, Charles Manson?
I had heard it before, but I'm still not sure I believe it. But basically, at one point in the 60s, Angela Lansbury's daughter started getting into a bit of trouble. Like she would be stealing money and food and stuff from the house. And she was hanging around with this guy that Angela Lansbury didn't really trust. So she just moved the whole family to Ireland for a few years. And the guy was apparently Charles Manson.
Wow. I mean, that's some hardcore, incredibly foresightness parenting there.
Let's
move to Ireland and get away from this serial killer.
Like she, you know, clearly the intuition that she brought to Jessica Fletcher, came from real life.
The hardcore nature of that as well. Yeah. You don't just move two streets away, or you don't just move to a different town. No, fuck it. We're going to Ireland.
Quite right.
Because they don't have any problems over there.
No, everything's fine in Ireland. So
we're all good.
Anyway, so just like a little word for Angela Lansbury, because I saw her on stage a few years ago. She was already, I think, 89 or 90, and she was still on stage in London every 8 nights a week, you know.
Amazing.
Killing it. Absolutely amazing woman. But anyway, typewriters.
Typewriters,
because of Murder, She Wrote, Jessica Fletcher.
So obviously, I would say The Shining has to be in the running for this.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say
but,
The Shining.
But Amon, before this very podcast started, stated, with no evidence to back it up, that he had the definitive answer to this question.
Definitive
and
answer.
I'm just desperate to hear how truly wrong he is. So please,
well,
please
this
continue.
Is interesting because for me, the definitive answer is The Shining.
Yeah,
so,
I would have said so.
Okay, so what have you got? All work and no play makes Amon a dull boy.
Indeed.
All work and no play makes Amon a dull boy.
Do you remember a film called Wanted?
Yes, I do.
I'm aware of it.
Do you remember a scene in which James McAvoy quits his job ethically and then takes his keyboard and thwacks
it's a good moment.
Around the head with it?
It's no The Shining.
It's no The Shining.
The letters fly out, getting fuck you, but the tooth is the you.
It's you can't handle
it's
the
good.
Tooth.
Yeah. No, it's a good moment. I rewatched Wanted quite recently. Yeah.
It's a fun film.
It is a fun film. Yeah. It is a fun film.
The Loom of Truth.
Indeed.
The Loom of Fate.
The Loom of Fate. The Loom of Fate. That's it.
The Loom of Fate. I wouldn't want to get that wrong.
So it's also the best Loom use.
Yeah, it is the best Loom.
Yeah. TV show. Yeah. And a movie. Yeah, that's a pretty good one. I feel like basically any scene in Barton Fink qualifies just by virtue of there's probably a typewriter there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Enigma. It's kind of a typewriter,
Jesus
isn't it?
Christ.
It's kind of a typewriter. Look, that
really
typewriter belonged to Mick Jagger, which makes it cool by default.
I mean...
Helen, you love your old-timey movies, which they have typewriters.
I do.
His Girl Friday must have
I was about to say, there is a great typewriting scene. There's basically just a great like reporting scene in His Girl Friday where she's trying to write up the story, essentially as it's happening around her. And all the other journalists are like gathered around watching her. Well, all the others. Cary Grant, who is... a host onto himself is gathered there like kind of editing over her shoulder as she types. It's just very cool. Yeah. Very sexy as well.
The bit in Predator when Dutch writes up his mission report on a typewriter, that's a particularly good moment.
That's a big moment.
Predator is not the answer to everything, given that there is literally, as I recall, zero typewriters.
Well, that's only because the CIA has got him pushing too many pencils.
Exactly. So if you want
what's
pencil
the matter?
Scenes,
CIA got you lifting too many typewriters.
About 100 at a time by the looks of it.
I think he eats them as far as I can tell.
He might.
Yeah. Paul Dano uses a typewriter to create himself the perfect girlfriend in Ruby Sparks. That's useful.
In no way problematic film.
Yeah.
Isn't it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I probably should have done some research on this or try to jog my memory. But All the President's Men, Woodward and Bernstein, clacking away on their little typewriters, doing their little journalisms.
Otter hadn't been invented then.
It hadn't been invented then. If Otter had been invented then, I wonder if they would have... taken down Nixon a lot earlier.
A lot quicker.
You know.
All of those tapes would have been transcribed seamlessly.
We know who broke into Watergate, and it was Arthur D2.
Arthur D2,
So All the President's Men, that's got some hot typewriter action, hasn't it? Just attractive men pounding out on the, pounding it out on the typewriter.
All right, stop reading my fanfics.
Wow.
that's a belter. I was trying to think about typewriters, and I was trying to extrapolate from there about typewriters and the stuff you can do with typewriters movies, with keys that are slightly wonky and typewriter ribbons. And so when people have looked because typewriter ribbons have records of what people have typed on them. So I'm pretty sure, am I right in thinking this, that in Jagged Edge, the 1984 thriller, Jagged Edge, Glenn Close and Jeff Bridges, Glenn Close figures out who the killer is because he has a very distinctive typewriter that has a slightly wonky key, and then she goes to the home of the killer, who I won't name, but it's Jeff Bridges. And
nothing to watch Jagged Edge. Thanks, Chris.
It's a good film. Try and act surprised when Jeff Bridges is the killer. I mean, it's so fucking obvious it's Jeff Bridges. But anyway, she goes to the home of the killer, and then she's let's have a fun, sexy time. And then she's like, oh no, I'm looking at your typewriter, and it's the wonky typewriter. And she's going, killer.
There's been a couple of films like that, hasn't there? There's a letter M that's wrong in one film where they have to like type in the M. They have to like physically handwrite in the M. I can see the page really clearly.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Dial M for murder.
I mean, it should have been, but I don't think it was. Does it count the scene where Jack Ryan is trying to get access to the deputy head of the CIA's computer at the same time that the guy's logging in, and they're both kind of dueling keyboards.
Hot keyboard action.
Very hot keyboard action. Although it's really more of the greatest fax scene or printer scene in history, It's
the joy of fax.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just the fax, ma'am.
And it's not gratuitous, unlike most fax scenes.
No, indeed. Yeah.
Or controversial, like most fax scenes. With Whistler's keyboard in sneakers.
Oh, vaccines, very good.
Is it, thank you.
Okay. Whistler's
keyboard, he has that Braille keyboard in sneakers and it's
yes,
amazing.
Yes. Mm.
Sneakers is usually the answer.
Sneakers is the answer to everything. Yeah. Sneakers is my passport, please verify me.
There's a really good keyboard scene in John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, which would be absolutely one of my Halloween choices, where one of the people, so basically they go into the group of scientists are called in to investigate a very, very, very old Catholic sect who are protecting this giant vial of green liquid in the basement of this church in Los Angeles.
I'm sure it's nothing to worry about.
Absolutely nothing to worry about. And the last guardian of this vial has carked it, essentially, and now the files acted all weird and they found all this stuff. And so Donald Pleasance, who's the priest at the church, calls in this group of young scientists, young bucks, to come in and take a look at it. Turns out, long story short, it's Satan in a jar and shit starts going awry and people start getting possessed, not by the Egyptian moon god Khonshu, but by Satan, or close to it, or the son of Satan. I think it's the son of Satan who's trying to free Satan from his interdimensional prison. Anyway, one of the creepiest scenes in it is one of the researchers is possessed and she is sitting at the keyboard just typing just staring at the space and typing impossibly fast.
All work and no play.
It's not all work and no play. Can you imagine? That would be amazing. What a callback that would be. But she's typing like, "You will not be saved. You will not be saved." You know, and someone peeks in and goes, "Hey, how's it going?" And she's really, really weird and creepy. Mm. Is that as weird and creepy as Jack Torrance in The Shining, which is what James was alluding to? But for people who don't know what it is, Jimbo, can you explain?
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy is the sum total of his novel, written over and over and over and over and over again. Which
better
is
than some
how I approach
I've read.
Many of my features. Yeah,
would not read.
That would be really funny. We should do that sometime in the magazine. You know, exclusive new Shining.
Yeah,
the real story behind The Shining, and then just like 3 pages.
Yeah.
Of
oh yeah, we should do that. No, yeah. We should totally do that. That's actually something I probably would have done back in the day.
I bet
just wasted a page.
That it is.
Oh dear.
That did remind me of something else, and not fast typing reminded me of Superman.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say Jonathan Pryce, and then I was going to think of slow typing when I think of Superman.
Well, no, but like that's why he has the job at the Daily Planet.
Because he's the fastest typist I've ever seen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, but Lois Lane is an extraordinarily slow typist, and she types like that. She types like
Hunt and Peck.
Yeah.
I get the idea that, you know, that's not her main skill, that her real skill is ferreting out the truth. But equally, come on, at some point, you're going to learn to use at least 2 fingers, Lois. Come on.
I love Lois Lane in Superman. And again, somehow, after last week's extended Superman detour, we're back on Superman again. I love Superman. And you say Lois is great at ferreting out the truth. I love her in that movie. I love Margot Kidder. I think she's great. It would have been nice for them to show that at some point.
I know. Yeah,
like they keep saying how great she is. And then we don't really get to see that.
You know that old storytelling rule.
Yeah.
Tell, don't show.
I know it well. When I rewatched Superman recently, and by the way, thanks to the people who pointed out that last week, it was Superman 3 that we were thinking of, that you were thinking of, with Pamela Stevenson. Yeah, Pamela Stevenson.
I had this like much blonder idea in my head.
She's very blonde in that movie.
She's very blonde. And I just looked at pictures of Miss Tessmacher and I was like, it doesn't, I just remember a different image.
Because
anyway.
Tessmacher, I'm sure, does something similar where she says something that she shouldn't know, or she has knowledge that she shouldn't really have because Lex is trying to like keep her
in the dark. Basically.
Yeah, in the dark. And so maybe I thought of Miss Tessmacher, but it's Pamela Stevenson in Superman 3, who's much smarter than she's letting on. But yes, Lois Lane, Clark Kent, we don't actually see him type that fast, but I guess he's trying to.
No, it's just that line, really. That's the reason I've got him in there.
But Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah. Commander James Bond.
He's typing away.
I don't understand. That's how any magazine works. Any publication, that's journalism. It's a perfectly accurate representation.
There's another instance of miraculous fake typing in the 5-star masterpiece known as Six Underground. Yeah, that movie, which did make me laugh when I watched it in school.
Oh, no. Has anyone ever been beaten to death by a typewriter in a movie?
I feel like it should have happened. It's not to death.
A typewriter as a keyboard, but
yeah. I mean, he's not beaten to death. He just has his teeth knocked out.
Yeah.
No one has been killed by a typewriter. If you do know of anyone who's been beaten to death by a typewriter in a movie, then do let us know. Apart from Misery, of course, which is also the film with the missing typewriter key, he said in a bit that clearly wasn't overdubbed the next day after he edited the podcast and thought of Misery. Totally, totally spontaneous in the studio bit, this bit. Okay. Slide into my DMs. I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter, and that is where you can find me if you want to have a question read out on the Empire Podcast. Thank you so much to Fertility Fun for this week's question, which also allowed us to wax lyrical about the great Angela Lansbury as well, who passed away this week. Shall we barrel straight into the movie news?
Sure.
This week?
Let's do that, folks. Let's do that. What has been happening, apart from obviously the sad passing of Angela Lansbury?
Blade.
Later.
Blazer. Blade is coming later, as are a great many things.
What specifically is coming
later? See, now you're asking me to bring up the details of this thing. So they've had a Marvel reshuffle, haven't they? Because they pushed Blade back by basically a year, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Wow.
Something like that,
so,
yeah.
And so the Marvel deck has been shuffled to accommodate Blade being pushed back so they can spend some time putting it together and reworking it now that they've had some personnel changes there. So,
yeah. I mean, finding a director would be the first thing.
Admittedly, that is always useful for a film.
Yes.
And potentially this means that, you know, if there were problems there that they've decided they needed to solve, then it's more important to get him right than get him early.
Absolutely. You know? So. Blade is not a movie you want to mess up. So I'm cool with them taking the time to get it right. Yeah.
I am, it has to be said, not of the particular Hive who is trying to recruit Michael Giacchino to direct Blade. Because
There's a Hive?
There's a whole thing going on. Yes, we should totally get Michael Giacchino to do it because he was so good.
Is it the G Hive?
I don't know what Hive it is, but whatever it is, just make that stop now.
Like, Werewolf by Night was fine, but not to the degree directorially that I'm going to trust Michael Giacchino as much as I love his music. Like, if you want to tell me Michael Giacchino is going to do the score for Blade, have at it. To direct Blade? No.
I have noticed, Amon, that you always call him Michael Giacchino instead of Giacchino, and I find that quite interesting.
Am I getting it wrong?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure you are.
I say Michael Giacchino.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
So am I the outlier in saying Giacchino?
No, I believe Giacchino is right.
Yeah.
Really?
And Helen's always right, so I must be.
Well, I don't know about that, but I believe that's the Italian way. I've been taking some Italian lessons on Duolingo.
It's a me.
In preparation, of course, for the Super Mario film.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, so you can understand.
To replace Chris Pratt as the voice of Mario.
Exactly.
Okie dokie.
And I'm pretty sure it would be Giacchino.
Yeah.
Giacchino.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just say good. How do I say it? Giacchino?
Yeah. I feel like you say Giacchino.
You know, I mean,
but
you get, you
now
get,
see, I'm questioning
now, now, you, now you're saying it to me, it does sound like that's something I would say. Giacchino.
Yeah. I mean, you get Hans Zimmer right. That's fine. So that's good.
Hans Zimmer.
Sorry, Helen. Sorry.
My bestie, Hans.
Hans Zimmer. If you would like more from, what's his name?
Hans Florian Zimmer.
Florian?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Hans Zimmer. We have an interview special with Hans Zimmer, which is up right now in our regular feed. It features Amon here talking to Hans Zimmer. You would have killed me if I'd given that to anyone else, wouldn't you?
I really would.
You literally would have.
No. Thank you for
coming. I fear for my life. Even now, I fear for my life.
As well you should. No. Thank you for coming to me for that. That was a lot of fun. Hans Zimmer, Gladiator was the score that alerted me to the power of film music. And it's still, to this day, my favorite score of all time.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's a great score. It's a great score. I love it to bits. Score.
Like, literally, my thing that...
The perfect score has a completely different component.
the thing that I do when I listen to new film scores, I listen to it all the way through. And I typically listen to it on
this
iTunes.
This is a revolutionary concept.
Yeah, I know.
I listen
to the whole thing before judging it.
No. Type 50, guys. Type 50.
No, I listen to it all the way through, and then I five-star the tracks, which I really, really love. With Gladiator, it's like every track. There's not a single bad track in Gladiator. It's that good.
It's very good. It's very good.
Barbarian Horde especially, it was the last 90 seconds of that is what really changed the game for me, because that is the scene in which Maximus takes off his mask and says, "I'm Maximus Decimus Meridius," and then the crowd is going wild, the music is going wild. It's a perfect, perfect scene, and the music is a big part.
Yeah, It's good, but I think it could have been improved by Michael Cicchino doing the score, because he does pun track titles.
He does.
And he could have done Maximus Overdrive or Gladiator, I Never Met Her. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
He could have done that instead.
I do like his puns. He has a strong pun game.
The pun game is strong.
So that's your favourite all-time score?
Yeah.
Helen, what's yours?
I think we've gone off the beaten path here, but okay.
I mean, we have a little bit. Honestly, it's probably John Williams, isn't it? It's probably one of those.
It's one of those. One of those. Good old Johnny Williams, the best of John Williams.
I had this already on the when we did the John Williams ranking. It was the hardest day of my life. I'm not going back.
Was it?
I don't remember what I've said before.
Was it?
I can tell you that the recent score I'm most feeling is The Rings of Power.
Yes, it is so good.
Incredible. I just don't know. I'm astonished every time. How can he compose films and TV when he's a bear?
When he's a bear.
I don't understand.
I know. And he's not even hiding it. Like, it's right there.
It's right there.
Also, why didn't he do the score for The Bear? It just doesn't make any sense.
It's too close to home.
Yeah.
Conflict of interest. At least The Revenant, you know. Come on, guys.
Yeah, or Paddington.
Yeah.
Or
Paddington. By Bear McCreary. There was...
Good answer, Helen.
Well,
the best of John Williams, says Helen.
What's yours, Jambo?
Jambo. I'm very, very, very fond of, obviously, Horner's Alien score, but it would actually have to be the original
Star Wars.
So
you actually like his Wrath of Khan score instead?
Yeah. Ooh, steady. I could say the same thing, but I enjoy the Predator score, and indeed when it was used in Back to the Future. But it would be John Williams' original Star Wars score is my all-time favorite, without doubt.
Except maybe by his E.T. score, or his Indiana Jones score.
Or his Schindler's List score.
Or his Superman score, or his Schindler's List score.
The Schindler's List theme might be the most beautiful theme.
Or his Close Encounters score.
You couldn't shoot down TIE fighters to that, though. So. No.
I cannot, and I will not, choose again. I refuse.
Yeah.
Chris.
No, I don't like it. No, fuck you. I'm not going to choose. I don't know. My favorite score. The Reservoir Dog soundtrack. No, my favorite score is probably Empire Strikes Back.
Okay. It's good. It's not as good as Star Wars, but it's good.
It's probably Empire Strikes
Back. It does have the Imperial March. I will grant you that.
It has the Imperial March.
Good.
It has the asteroid field. It has Yoda's theme. Yeah. It has Han and Leia's theme. It has all, you know, it takes the fairly simplistic score of the first movie and builds upon it melodically.
I still have an awful lot of time for the Phantom Menace score. Not just for Duel of the Fates.
So do I.
But again, the last bit, and remember I did this for the 3-Fat Structure during the pandemic, like the fact that that final piece of music, the celebration anthem, is the Emperor's theme in a major key, and that just blew my mind when I found that out. Mm-hmm. That is incredible.
Yeah. Didn't you think of Anakin's theme when he was on the toilet?
I have no information on that and refuse to engage.
Maybe I've made that up.
This was a serious thing. That's how he came up with
it. He was in a restroom or something like that, and he heard the pipes.
His pipes? Or
and the pipes spoke to him in Anakin's theme.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think that the score for Home Alone was inspired by the noise the Central Line trains make when the doors open?
Yes.
Okay.
I couldn't pick the score for Home Alone.
The first couple of notes of the Home Alone score. Basically, every time I get on the Central Line, the Circle and District. Every time
they do make distinct sounds.
They make a distinct sound, and it sounds like they're about to go into the full theme from Home Alone.
See, Home Alone. When I hear the theme from Home Alone, I know that Christmas has begun, and it's time to throw my TV out the window. And it's a beautiful time for me when I hear those oh so recognizable bars from Home Alone. What is it? How does it go?
That's not the theme bit, though.
Are you sure?
What are you singing?
That's music from Home Alone, but that's not the bit I'm thinking of.
Okay,
Okay.
I don't even know what we were talking about.
Like, it's okay. Luckily, as an award-winning podcast host, I'm on top of things. So Michael Cicchino is not our choice to direct a Blazer.
No, yes.
Who do you think should do it? We talked about this 2 weeks ago, but you know the fact that they've pushed it back a year shows that they are waiting to get the right composer to to moonlight as a director. But they've also pushed to Deadpool 3 with Hugh Jackman as Wolverine back only a couple of months, but that's now out on the 8th of November 2024. The Fantastic Four is moving to 2025
because they still ain't cast them.
They haven't cast them. But can't they just shoot the movie and then just put them in afterwards using special effects?
Wow. So cynical about the Marvel process from you, Chris, of all people.
I'm just saying, you know, this is a revolutionary new technique. Mm. We shoot the film and then we cast the
video.
As much as I'm excited to see all these films, honestly, them having more time to do all of this makes me really happy.
Yeah.
You know, we've lamented recently in terms of the workload that visual effects artists have with the increased volume that the MCU.
I've started training up so I can do this. I think there's a lucrative gap in the market here.
The thing is, it's not lucrative, isn't it, Chris? That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Look, I know what I get paid by this company. Pretty much anything.
So
it's lucrative.
Giving them more time to get it right on a script level and a visual effects level, to me, I think that's going to pay dividends in the long run.
You know what? I hope they're not doing that. I hope they push the film back and they just sit around and stare at each other for 6 months. Should we get the script better? Nah.
Sometimes you need a moment of calm in order to be able to work at full pace.
Did you say calm or Kang?
Sure.
Because the Kang dynasty is staying put, as of right now, says here in the Empire website, on the 2nd of May 2025. But Secret Wars has moved back by 6 months. It is now back a year. It's gone a full year after the Kang Dynasty, which is the next Avengers movie, and Avengers Secret Wars is back a full year, and that might mean Dessa Daniel Cretton might be able to direct both.
What?
Maybe. In the same way the Russos obviously did Infinity War and Endgame back to back in that way. Very exciting. But my understanding is you can shoot a movie now and you don't need to cast. Did you see Hitchcock would have loved this year? He would have been like, actors can't actually be props. This is incredible. Did you see the announcement this week that they have announced a remake of Barbarella,
which
will star Sydney Sweeney? And they were like, the headline at Variety was, Sydney Sweeney set to star in Barbarella remake, which doesn't have a director or a producer or a writer. It's like, so how set to star is she? Exactly. Is she in costume right now, just waiting for them to get a director? And she's like, wherever it is, guys, I am ready to rock and roll.
Well, there is a writer involved, I guess. The Kingsman's Carl Gajicek?
Good stuff.
Gajicek?
He wasn't attached when I
Yeah, he's working on the script, apparently. Yeah, I mean, he hasn't turned it in yet, I guess. And then Michael Bay and company Platinum Dunes are producing, so presumably they have set her in place. But you know, if she's at the point now where her attachment like gets something the green light, then great, fantastic for her.
Who is she?
She's,
for people who don't know,
she is big in Euphoria. She's in The White Lotus. She's been making a certain amount of noise, you know, like as a young rising starlet. So this is a big step up, I think, but a cool one.
And what is?
What is
Barbarella?
And what is her net worth? Barbarella is the 1968 film that starred Jane Fonda.
You just fucking Googled
it. I did. I wasn't 100% sure of the year, but 60s film starring Jane Fonda at her absolute hottest. Although, you know, she's still pretty hot now, to be fair, like 60 years later. She's a space adventurer who has to track down a guy called Duran Duran, who inspired the group. And she does so by like defeating, for example, the Orgasmatron by basically out-orgasming the Orgasmatron and surviving it. And it's just like a crazy big space romp with lots of semi-naked people in very cool costumes that are mostly see-through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like that's about it, right?
That's about it.
Yeah.
That's about it. Sold. It is a camp space romp. I am slightly pessimistic about the chances of this getting made, but hey, Sydney Sweeney is set to star.
Been talked about before and hasn't happened before, so you know, it could not happen again. of this has not happened before.
And it will not happen again.
To quote Battlestar Galactica.
To Bear McCreary.
Back to Bear McCreary. Everything comes back to Bear.
Everything comes back to Bear. Yes.
A couple of other stories. The next Poirot film is happening. It will be A Haunting in Venice. And for those of you playing...
Spoiler, there's no actual ghost.
How dare you spoil it for us?
It's the chambermaid dressed up as a ghost going, ooh, and she would have got away with it if it hadn't been for that crazy Belgian detective.
Well, if it hadn't been for those pesky moustaches, and also if it hadn't been for Jamie Dornan, Tina Fey, Michelle Yeoh, Kyle Allen, Ali Khan, Emma Laird, Kelly Riley, Camille Cotta, and Ricardo Scamarcio. So
That's quite a long list of suspects.
Obviously, it's a Poirot film. You've got to have like a million actors in it.
Round up the unusual suspects. I have to say that I am quite excited about this, despite Death on the Nile.
I didn't mind that film.
I didn't like it as much as I liked Murder on the Orient, Murder on the Orient Express. And I didn't love that movie, to be honest. Why am I excited about this? I'm excited about this because I just love that a moustache that mad can still be unleashed upon cinema screens.
A moustache that has, and I cannot stress this enough, its own origin story.
Its own origin story. And its own postcode and weather system well. That's true. Big old tash. No, I've got a soft spot for what Kenneth Branagh is doing with Hercule Poirot. And I look forward to actually being able to understand a word he says this time around.
An interesting little factoid about this one, though, is that it's set post-World War II. And that is unusual for Agatha Christie adaptations, which are all between the two World Wars.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that bit in the
So it's a sort of like semi-retired Hercule Poirot.
Older Hercule.
When he thought he was out. They pull him back.
Essentially, yes, but I wonder if this means like this is going to be the end of his like trilogy of Poirots or something, like if this is a sort of finale.
And it's an unusual one. This is a relatively obscure Agatha Christie Hercule Poirot story, and they are positioning it as a supernatural thing. So it's maybe they've rejected it. Maybe Hercule Poirot is coming up against the boogeyman. What's the boogeyman? As a matter of fact, maybe that's going to be the end of the movie, but. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Soft spot for these movies, and I love the fact he wins the Oscar and then does this. It's almost as if by stealth, like they've just announced that they're literally about to start filming in time for a release next year. So yeah, I'm buying up for that. Hercule Poirot and goes to a séance on All Hallows Eve, and someone gets murdered.
I just hope that this Poirot is free of any drama, because the last two have not been.
Also, little bits of news this week. Andrew Stanton has signed up for a new sci-fi film, I'm excited.
Sci-fi film.
I'm a John Carter apologist, apart from
Me
anything
too.
Else. Yeah. And a live-action movie again, In the Blink of an Eye, it's called. And it reportedly seeks to tackle the entire history of the world and the nature of life, love, hope, and connection via three intersecting storylines. Big, ambitious sci-fi is my jam, baby. So I am all over this. I cannot wait. And I think Andrew Stanton is great. So let's hope it gets a better break than John Carter did.
And indeed was a better film.
It's a good film. It just didn't get,
It came out after, everything that had come up before was taken inspiration from.
I know. I do know that. And also, I mourn for Taylor Kitsch's career because he should have been much bigger than he is, because it's Tim fucking Riggins.
Riggins, maybe.
He's great. And yet, we have Battleship.
Yeah. It was that, and then he had X-Men Origins, Wolverine, right? It was Gambit.
I think it was before John Carter, yeah.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah.
It was this and Battleship were the two ones that were close together.
Yeah. That didn't quite work out for him, which is a shame. Which is a shame.
Something that might work out better is Nicholas Hoult joining Robert Eggers' Nosferatu as like the sort of handsome hero type, I suspect. That seems like good casting.
Yeah,
that's interesting. So he's going straight from Renfield into Nosferatu.
Yeah, a little bit of a change, huh?
Interesting.
And obviously he'll be taking on Bill Skarsgård's Nosferatu and trying to save the winsome Lily Rose Depp. It isn't, but I'm just sort of editorializing.
Winsome is a word that doesn't get used enough.
Thank you. I'm trying to bring it back.
Well, you win some, you lose some.
Speaking of winning some or losing some, the Spirited teaser trailer came up this week. That's Ryan Reynolds getting the kind of somewhat Christmas Carol treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So he seems to be a modern executive who is aware of the Christmas Carol story in a Scrooge-y type way, but more Ryan Reynolds-y. I feel like both him and his co-star Will Ferrell are very much playing the roles we have seen from them before. But what the trailer and the teaser trailer does quite well is set up the fact that this is a musical, that there are a lot of musical numbers, that they're written by Pasek and Paul, who of course did that film I Don't Talk About, and some stuff on stage, as well as The Greatest Showman. So,
What film do you not talk about?
La La Land.
Oh, the excellent La La Land.
Well, in fairness, they only wrote the lyrics. They only wrote the lyrics in La La Land. The music was written by Justin Hurwitz. And those songs are incredible and a million miles better than anything in The Greatest Showman.
I didn't say they were better than The Greatest Showman. I just said that they
I don't know if I can join you on that.
Anyway.
That the success of The Greatest Showman will be a mystery that will dog me to my grave.
I like The Greatest Showman.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's confirmation.
There was another trailer for Enola Holmes 2.
Yes, there was.
Millie Bobby Brown returning as the titular Enola Holmes. This time she's hired to locate a missing sister. So yeah, I really liked the first film and I'm glad that we've got a sequel. Also, I know that I'm the guy first, but the score for the first film by Daniel Pemberton is great.
Pemberton is freaking great.
He's
He could direct Blade.
In fact, he should.
He should direct Blade.
It's
Let's
official.
Make it happen.
Daniel Pemberton to direct Blade.
He has a penchant for red trousers.
A penchant.
Right? So if he got blood all over them, it wouldn't show. I feel like this is a perfect solution.
Okay. Well, that's it. If that's all you need.
He's got some red on him.
He has.
That's how it goes. It's really good.
Is that Home Alone?
No, that's Enola Holmes.
All right. I think we have exhausted the possibilities of movie news for this week. Shall we have a guest?
Let's do it.
Shall we have a guest? Who do you want? Do you want Jamie Lee Curtis or Oliver Jackson Cohen? Actually, I'm not even going to give you a choice. You're getting Jamie Lee Curtis.
All right.
So, Jamie Lee Curtis, you know her. She's the star of Halloween and Halloween 2. And Halloween H2O, and Halloween Resurrection, and Halloween Kills, and now Halloween Ends, which brings the story of her character Laurie Strode to a conclusion for what I'm guessing is the third time. This is, of course, the conclusion of David Gordon Green's Halloween trilogy, which brings Michael Myers back into conflict with Laurie Strode, the original heroine of the original movie, and basically retcons everything else post John Carpenter's Halloween out of existence. And 1 year on from Halloween Kills, actually 4 years on in the movie, we find Laurie Strode back, ready to do battle, maybe for the final time, that's what the title says, with Michael Myers. Very interesting and exciting indeed. Now, Amon here spoke to Jamie Lee Curtis when she came over to London a couple of weeks ago. Was this when I had the COVID? Did I have the cove?
I think
you had the cove.
Yeah.
Ah, man. Did she say trauma to you?
She did not.
I haven't listened to it yet.
Oh, come on, man.
I know. I failed. But the end of this interview is a little bit special. Shall I say what?
No. That's not it. That's not
spoilers.
Yeah. But
Michael Myers turns up and finally speaks. He's like, finally, I want to unburden myself.
Even though she doesn't say trauma, I think that you'll be very happy with how this interview ends.
You'll get a kick out of this.
It's awesome. She's such a cool woman. She's got a really good energy about her. I enjoy time.
There's a great energy inside the gym. And there's a great energy inside this interview as well. So here we go. Amon talking to... Oh, no. Guys, can you hear that?
No, I can't.
No sound.
Now it's time for Jamie Lee, Jamie Lee, Jamie Lee. Now it's time for Jamie Lee, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Wow. How did that happen? Here's Jamie Lee Curtis. Do please enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the star of Halloween Ends, Jamie Lee Curtis. How are you?
Hello, Empire.
It's good to see you.
And you.
Congratulations on the film.
Thanks.
I have to say, it wrong-footed me in the best type of way, because given what happens at the end of the last film, I was not expecting the positivity at the outset of this film, and I really enjoyed that. So how important was it to you to showcase that positivity at the outset of this film?
Well, I don't think if we really think about how the second film ends with Karen's brutal murder, where do you go? Like, what's like, how high can you go on a kind of emotional, physical, sound effect score level? Like, you would have to start the third movie like in space in order to be able to really connect the dot. What if you are a fan of music at all? What I love about music is that there are pauses in music. There are interludes. There are quiet bits. There are very melodic bits. What David Gordon Green so cleverly did is he said, we all need a little bit of a break. It was important to show a passage of time so that everybody can take a deep breath and give Laurie Strode the one thing that she's never had, which is help, support, mm-hmm. counseling, an ability to grieve in a safe space. All of the what we now, all over the world, understand is the beginning of mental health awareness, grief counseling, etc. So that we start the movie with a Laurie who has processed the acute feelings of loss and grief, and she is attempting a fragile ecosystem of an attempt to live today without the constant fear. She's not healed. She is never going to heal, and she's never going to be recovered. That wound will always be open, but it will have a thin layer of tissue over it, and she will be able to walk without a bandage. And that's who we meet. And I loved that that's who we meet.
You've been playing this role of Laurie Strode across 4 decades now. Have you always known what you wanted the ultimate end for the character to be?
Oh, such a good question. Wow.
And or has that evolved over time for you?
Such a good question. Wow. I'm a sober person. I'm in recovery for 20, almost 4 years. And there is a phrase we have in recovery that's always stuck with me, which is be where your feet are. That we can all live in our heads, and those that rabbit hole of our brains and our minds with certain stimuli can really do a number on us all. There's not a human being that doesn't know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely right.
And so I'm not someone who future trips. I would never try to imagine some scenario of an end. I also don't write them. When I start to write something, then I feel like I'm in the driver's seat. But I'm not in the driver's seat. I'm in the co-pilot seat, or I'm in the passenger seat, or I'm in the back seat. And so I haven't. I was so happy and moved by the way this movie concludes, which will ultimately conclude my participation in the Halloween movies. And it's sad. It's brutal. It's real. And haunting. And I think that's really the only true end of a story like this.
Absolutely. What was your reaction when they called cut for the
last time? Well, I knew it was coming. And it was a pretty simple shot of me in a car. So once we had done the tour of the driving, I knew we weren't going to do that like 20 times. Yeah. I knew we actually went out one more time because they wanted to change the camera angle. But even that first time coming back to base camp, after driving around with a camera attached to the car I was in, I knew. So there's a natural feeling. I was crying before I ever got the door open.
Laurie is writing a memoir in this movie. Has Jamie Lee Curtis ever considered writing a memoir?
Oh, I've considered it. I've been asked to do it many, many times. I've been offered vast sums of money to do it, which I'm very flattered that someone would do that. I will not do that. I've done a lot of things for money. Wasn't that a lyric for a song? But I won't do that. Okay. Like, it's the one, you know, my memories of human beings, my relationship with them is like mine. And I'm pretty open, and I'm a weapon of mass promotion on the socials. And so I put out a lot of stories and personal stuff, I'm never going to betray personal intimacies and family intimacies and conflicts for money.
Yeah.
I will not do that.
That's fair.
And by the way, I don't have to do that because I have saved my money. I've made some money. You know, I've made some good investments. Like, I'm very mindful. But I do understand there are a lot of people who don't. And then you have to go, well, that is something I can write about. And it's very important for them and cathartic for them and all the rest of it. So I also appreciate it. My friend Jennifer Gray just wrote a wonderful memoir. Fantastic. Mm. And it made me, reading that made me go, huh.
I need to reconsider.
Should I reconsider that? And then I realized, no.
Okay. I've heard that you are a scaredy cat when it comes to horror movies.
You should have been with me at the fake Halloween house here today, where they had a camera on me watching some people go through it. And I didn't know when they said, you're going to watch them. I was like, okay, whatever. I'm not paying attention. And then I got in there and they had a camera on me. Yeah. And I'm watching on a screen, basically a horror movie. I don't know when the things jump. I literally said, wait. I was not nice and I was cranky. Mm. And I turned to people and was like, no, I'm not. I put my hand up on the screen in front of it. Like, I'm not watching. What are we doing? Are you kidding me? No. I'm not. What? Would somebody tell me, when does he jump out? No, come here. You come here. When does he jump out? Does he jump out? And is he going to, don't fuck with me, fellas. I'm not interested.
I am exactly the same. I was watching a bunch of this movie through my fingers.
Well, but by the way, I don't know if it was my job, if I had to watch these kind of things, if I would say I'm not, like, what am I going to send you my shrink bill? And you're going to pay my shrink bill because you forced me to watch? That's traumatizing. I'm not joking. Someone in the other room will tell you.
Yep.
Say yes, Heidi. Say yes. Just say the word yes. Say the word yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi.
So, I mean, I'm not joking.
Yeah. No.
So I was angry because I felt like they were putting me through the thing I don't want to be put through.
Absolutely. And those types of rooms, those types of experiences, definitely not for me either. I did want to switch gears really quickly to a film called Knives Out, which I absolutely love. I know that you are the official spokesperson for the Thrombey family, and you made the announcement that you guys in family counseling, I hope that's going well.
Yeah, it is.
Have you had any conversations with Ryan about potentially coming back for another one somewhere down the road?
No. What Ryan explained to everybody very early on was, well, first of all, Knives Out is a miracle movie. Yeah. I had no idea that the movie we made in Massachusetts was going to be that movie. I just didn't know. I knew it was fun. I knew people were good, but I just didn't know what Ryan was going to do with it. And then I saw the movie and I was like, oh my God. And then you could have had a really good movie where we all went like, oh my God. And then it just came out, made a little money and just, oh, there was that movie. And then it caught fire.
Yeah.
And that was the miracle of it all. It was like, this just became that movie. The same thing happened with Everything Everywhere All at Once. Same exact thing. A movie you don't expect to be much. It's like, wow, this is fun to make. I had a good time. I loved the people I worked with. Boom. And then the Daniels put that movie together and you go, oh my God. So.
That is my favorite movie of the year so far, Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And yeah. I didn't have a clue.
I actually have a quote from Ryan Johnson, because we spoke to him recently for his second
for Glass
Out.
Onion. Yeah, sure.
He says this, if we can put Jamie Lee Curtis in the mustache as another character, I'll do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
So, is that what it's going to take to get Jamie Lee Curtis in the Knives Out film?
Let me see. He's being very kind. I am. I think it's more a testament to my head cheerleader nature. I think what he's saying is it's fun to have me around. It was fun to be around that movie. I'm collaborative. I'm around a lot. I'm active I'm always watching and waiting and being like, ah. But that's just my nature. I think he's just being cute and sweet and nice. once that movie was successful, we all understood that they were going to carry on the Benoit Blanc story and then bring in different crimes, and it would be distracting to bring in people from, it's not like my husband's movies where he uses the same actors in all the different movies, but that's what Chris does. Ryan, each movie will be different, and except for Benoit, which is the way you focus a movie over and over again on, and Daniel is so great.
Yeah. Speaking of mentioned fun to be around, I watched, or rather rewatched, the Everything Everywhere All at Once blooper reel, which is epic.
I don't know if I've ever seen it.
Oh, it's amazing. You're doing the Wucha sound effect. You're doing,
They were trying to teach us. Well, because remember, that movie, like Ryan's movie, is in their head.
Right.
They're the only people, as much as they can articulate what it's about. And my favorite thing, if you read on Instagram, they posted, go back, because they don't post a lot. They posted their real thoughts and the intellectual underpinnings of that movie. Mm. And it's so deep and so articulate.
Yeah.
It's shocking. That's like when we were making the movie, you don't know that about them. Mm-hmm. They know what they want. They go, okay, good. We're good here. Okay, now we need this. But you don't know what they're... I didn't know anything. And then I saw it. And then I was like, oh, so much bigger than anything I could have imagined. Knives Out, so much bigger. And what a thrill for me to have been able to do those two movies and these three Halloween movies in my 60s. Yeah. That's crazy.
I've heard that you had a Michelle Yeoh rap at the Everything Everywhere All at Once set that you did. Do you still remember the lyrics?
You know what? It wasn't that elaborate. It was the first time I ever met her.
Oh, wow.
Like, I walked into the little rehearsal space and I looked at her and I said, you say Michelle, I say Michelle, you say Yo, Michelle Yo, Michelle Yo. Yep. And she immediately picked it up. You know, she's the badass that I know, Michelle Yo. She can punch and kick so high, Michelle Yo, whatever. I don't remember. It was a stupid little like high school cheer, but it began with, you say Michelle, I say Yo. And that's how it began. And that's how it will end. And I fucking hope that she wins an Oscar and that I get to be the first person that makes up the rap. You say, I say Michelle, you say Yo, Michelle Yo, Michelle. She's the Oscar, you know, she's an Oscar winner that I know, Michelle Yo, Michelle Yo. She is brilliant and so kind, Michelle Yo, Michelle Yo. She will fucking blow your mind, Michelle Yo, Michelle Yo.
It just writes itself.
It writes itself. So it writes itself, Oscar voters.
Amazing. You heard it here first. Oscar for Michelle Yo.
Oh, for sure. And Oscar for John Carpenter for score for Halloween.
Yes.
It's a campaign I'm starting.
Fantastic. I'll get behind both. I'm going to start the hashtag right now.
Right now.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your
time. God bless everyone. Take care.
Okay, so that was Jamie Lee Curtis rapping. I'm not sure how I feel about that, if I'm honest.
It's freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Honestly, okay. I defy any Oscar voter to listen to that and not immediately vote Michelle Yeoh for Best Actress. It was that good.
It's that good. Jamie Lee Curtis rapping is that good. It'll make you vote for Michelle Yeoh. Oh, because that's what she was rapping about. Okay. It's like, what? Yes. Yes.
Should really listen to these things before.
Nah. I'm far too busy. Far too busy. I barely listen to it a minute. You know? You could get all sorts of libel through in these interviews. Honestly. Anyway, that was Jamie Lee Curtis. And now let's talk about the films that are out in the multiplex or indeed your Sofaplex this week. I'm going to step back largely from the microphone because for various reasons I haven't seen anything. Hands up, fully admit that, you know, it's very, very bad. Like Superman at the end of Superman 2, I'm apologizing to the president. I let you down, Mr. President, but it won't happen again. That's what I'm saying. And I fly off, fly above the earth, heroic cape fluttering in the breeze.
No capes.
But Superman could have turned back time and then gone and watched the films and then done the podcast.
Or Cher could have as well.
Yeah. Cher could have done,
if she could find a way.
Yeah, we should get Cher in here to review the movies.
Oh my God, that would be the greatest day of my life.
What would Cher think?
Walking in Memphis Belle.
All caps.
What? Were you just desperately trying to think of it? Okay.
Yeah. She's not in Memphis Belle, is she?
So she could review it for us.
He's trying to play on Cher titles, like, you know, instead of just like Jesse James, it'd be just like the assassination of
Jesse James. Exactly that. Yeah.
Is Cher well known for that song?
Walking in Memphis?
Yeah, she did a good cover of it.
Good cover of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially if you enjoy Postmodern Prometheus, the episode of The X-Files.
Okay, I hear she's a big fan of David Cronenberg. She loves Dead Ringers for love. Dead Ringer, because she's on that song.
Yeah.
Isn't she on the song?
Yeah, she is. She sang it with Meatloaf.
Yeah. Wow, that's a talent.
The
personality and entertainment.
The food stuff. Rather than the food stuff.
Why is this happening? Hey, let's review some films.
Let's review some films. Shall we start with Halloween Ends, which I have not seen, but Amon and Helen have?
Sure. Yeah.
Hell's Bells.
Yes. So we pick up the story once again. We're back in Haddonfield, Illinois, and we actually don't start with Laurie Strode. We start with another story sort of a year after we last were in town. So then we jump forward another few years, and Laurie, Jamie Lee Curtis, and her granddaughter, Allison, played by Andy Matichek, are trying to basically rebuild their lives, be normal people with the shadow of Michael Myers finally gone, it seems, forever. There's a bit more flirting between Laurie and Officer Hawkins, Will Patton's character, when they meet up in the supermarket. But the real story here is about Corey Cunningham, a young man played by Rowan Campbell, who Allison meets actually via Laurie and sort of forms an attachment to. He has tragedy in his past.
No.
Tragedy.
Yeah. And the feeling's gone and he can't go out. No. But the question is, can he sort of, you know, can he and Allison make a go of it? And then some bad things start to happen and this whole town is put back under threat, basically. I really didn't like the last one. I really, really didn't like the last one because I felt like it was trying to push this whole, you know, hysteria is bad for us as a community. It's a terrible thing. Metaphor.
Evil dies tonight.
Yeah, when actually the whole thing is, it is entirely rational and reasonable to be scared of Michael Myers because he goes around like knifing people to death in horrible ways. And it is absolutely sensible to be worried about that. So the metaphor of the last film absolutely didn't work for me. And in this one, I think it's more about, you know, it is about trauma. It is about dealing with bad things having happened in your past and trying to move on and trying to rebuild your life. And how do you do that? And the question is, how do you especially do that if bad things keep happening in the world and there are still bad things of one kind or another somewhere out there? So there's some interesting ideas here that I didn't actually think entirely worked. I thought character-wise, people made decisions that made no sense to me. I thought that, you know, it was inconsistent from one moment to the next about, you know, who Laurie is, who Allison is. And that really frustrated me and kept taking me out of the film because every time I'd sort of get into a moment, somebody would just change the kind of the stakes and change the way things were going in a way that didn't feel organic or earned or right. To me, at least. There is gore here for the gore hounds. Like, there is some horrible stuff. There are some horrible deaths that will, I think, keep people engaged. But what this says about kind of culpability and guilt and moving on, again, just doesn't feel coherent or powerful to me in the way that I wanted it to. So I find this incredibly frustrating. I'm sure people who just want to see some people get stabbed on Halloween are going to be maybe happy with this. But I think fans of the franchise probably after more, and especially for something that purports to be the end of the franchise and a real, you know, finale for Laurie Strode. And I wanted this to be really, really worthy of her as a character. Mm.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I've got a very complicated relationship with the first two David Gordon Green Halloweens. I'm I'm nervous about this.
I mean, there is ambition to do more. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? There really is ambition. I just don't feel like it's always achieved, basically. Yeah.
So with Laurie, Amon, you know, does she get covered in blood at some point in this film, or is she cowardly in this film? Wow. Basically, what I'm saying is it a case of red Laurie, yellow Laurie?
Oh, that was labored, wasn't it?
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Red Laurie, yellow Laurie, red Laurie, yellow Laurie, red Laurie.
Have you told them about your favorite game to play in?
My car game, no. Car. I have a game like that.
Is it yellow car?
Well, I do yellow car, but I also play red Laurie, yellow Laurie. So if you can see a red Laurie and a yellow Laurie on the road at the same time, you say red Laurie, yellow Laurie, and you win.
What?
She's very passionate about this game.
This is not a true rule of the game. This seems
this is
like
a different game to Yellow Car. There's also Yellow Car. That's a whole other game. But this is
you
Red
never
Laurie,
stop
Yellow
playing
Laurie.
Yellow Car. This is the thing.
Now that I introduced you to Yellow Car several years ago, and you've been playing it ever since. You may
I don't know. Did you introduce me to Yellow Car?
Yes, when we went to Barcelona.
Was that genuinely that? Are there a lot of yellow cars in Barcelona? I don't remember.
It was a very high scoring weekend.
Wow.
That makes it sound like we had a dirty weekend in Barcelona.
We did. Helen and I went to Barcelona together.
Our team was there.
It was quite gaudy.
Hey.
Anyway, Halloween ends. Yeah, I
think enough of this ramblessing.
I think I liked it a teensy bit more than you, Helen. Although I
not
do,
hard.
Although I do agree that it was thematically all over the place. Like I couldn't get a handle on Laurie. At times it feels like she has a death wish, and at times it feels like she wants to live, and it goes back and forth between those two things quite a bit, not all the time making sense as to why. But I did like, I think part of this why I like this film a little bit more than Halloween Kills. Halloween Kills, there are so many people making so many dumb decisions in that film that I think I could be heard at one point screaming, "Why are you going there alone, you dumb buffoon?" I didn't find myself doing
you didn't
that.
Hold back.
I didn't find myself doing that as much watching this film. So on that level, I count Halloween Ends as a win. I also like the positive start to this that I say in the interview, but it sort of wrong-footed me a little bit, especially given how the last film ended, that we do get to see, at least for the first few minutes or so, a Laurie who is not, I guess not suffering from trauma, going a little bit too far, but she is living a much better life than what we've seen from her in previous times. And that was nice to see. It's also very bold and ballsy in that, I mean, I say bold and ballsy, Helen might disagree, in terms of it waits a long time to show you Michael in this film.
That's interesting. Okay. But people will come to this for Laurie Strode versus Michael Myers for the 14th and final time. Does the film, will they be sated?
They will be sated, but they'll have to wait a while. And in terms of this movie compared to previous Halloween movies, I think there's a lack of tension here that fans might be a little upset about. But when it comes time for shit to go down, I had a good time with it.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because one of my big problems with Halloween Kills was how it kept them apart for the entire movie. Which is realistic because it was on the same night and she had the sucking chest wound and she wasn't exactly going to get up and run around and you know, especially at her advanced age, you know, she wasn't really going to kick then, ass and take names and
then you might have some issues with this movie.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. But they're in the same room at some point is what.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, but, without getting the spoilers, but which did not happen in Halloween Kills.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Sounds like you guys are somewhere in the 2 or 3 camp, and that's exactly where we ended up, because we gave Halloween Ends 2 stars. Next up, we have a film, one of Netflix's Knockdown Ginger specials. It is Mila Kunis in Luckiest Girl Alive. Amon, you saw this movie. James, you pointedly did not.
I refused to.
Okay, let's get into this. Why?
So, I was going to watch this one because it's obviously let's say I had some logistical issues getting screeners of the other films, which we won't go into because it's a bit inside baseball, but I could watch this. I was going to watch this and I couldn't remember the name of it. So I just Googled Netflix Mila Kunis, as you would do, and the name of the film came up. But the first story I saw was an article where saying people who had been watching this film were kicking off because it doesn't come with a trigger warning. Now, obviously, it's about school shooting, but basically it mentions there's sexual violence in it, but people are saying this should have said it contains scenes of intense sexual violence at the beginning and should have had a massive trigger warning, and people were kicking off and Netflix had dropped the ball by not including this trigger warning. Now, I have a real aversion to films that contain sexual violence, and the idea of watching a film that contains intense sexual violence was a hard pass from me. So I was like, I'm just not watching it. So sorry, Netflix, on general principle, I'm not watching your film with intense sexual violence. So I suppose my question, or we can dig into the reasons why, but my question will be, like, Amon, should it have had a trigger warning for extreme sexual violence?
1,000% yes.
So I made the right decision.
Yeah.
But shouldn't you have seen the film and then made that judgment call?
It depends on what you want. Like, for me, like, I it would have upset me, I'm sure, enormously, and I'm not prepared to put myself through that. So, like certain films, like, obviously, I would never watch Irreversible for obvious similar reasons. I remember watching Leaving Las Vegas, and the sexual assault scene in that was so, like, I almost, like, had a panic attack in the cinema. Like, it really, really upset me. So it's just things like that. I feel like we don't need to see these things. I don't need them in films. It's just unnecessary, and I don't like it. So sorry, that not for me is the answer there. Hard pass all round.
Fair play.
Is it for you, Amon? That's the question.
Well, let's get into it.
Oh, that's a bit loaded now.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's not for me. Is it for you? Yeah. Is it?
It's not, I'm judging you. Like, it can be used non-gratuitously. It can be used to make points and say serious things about the world.
This is true. But Luckiest Girl Alive, this is based on Jessica Knowles' New York Times bestselling novel. She's also the screenwriter for this movie. It focuses on Annie Fanelli, played by Mila Kunis. And things are looking up for her at the start of this movie. She writes for The New Yorker. She's in line for a promotion as she's about to get married. But then a director of a crime documentary invites her to tell her side of the story because she's a survivor of a school shooting. And that sort of sends her into a tailspin because she's forced to confront stuff about her past, which then threatens her present. The first and most important thing to say about this for me, Mila Kunis is great in this movie. It's a really strong lead performance. And in this film, she plays a woman who has been saying what everybody wants to hear for a very long time, that she's sort of forgotten where her sort of real personhood is. And it's about her getting back in touch with that. And the journey is very, very compelling at times because of how great Mila Kunis is in the role. So I really like that. It's very introspective. She's very magnetic, especially as the film gets into the third act. She's, some of the things, some of the scenes that she's tasked with, she lands them in a very affecting and poignant way. So I really like that. The main issue with this is that not only do you have the school shooting, you've got the sexual assault. And it's trying to merge those two storylines together, and it just doesn't work because it's too much for a two-hour film. Not only have you got those two very heavy storylines, but you've got a lot of scenes taking place in the past as well as the present. It's too much. It's not able to get into anything on an effective, really deep level. It's just too much of it. It's too surface level. I actually think this would have worked better as a miniseries where it could have given a better amount of time to both of these heavy storylines. Trying to do them both at the same time just doesn't quite work. And as you say, I think they could have been a lot more tasteful with how they showed the sexual assault and the school shooting. They are very graphic. That's unnecessary for me in a film like this. So, yeah.
All right. Okay. What would you give it? Jimbo, you'd give it 1 star, obviously, sight unseen. Every week I'm going to get you a review of a film you haven't seen.
I mean, let's do it. Yeah.
Let's do it.
1 star then for The Luckiest Girl Alive from me.
Amon, what would you give it?
I'd give it 2 stars, but I didn't hate this. Mila Kunis, again, is very, very good. I just think the stuff that it's dealing with, it needed a lot more time, a lot more real estate to get into it as effectively as the storylines warrant.
Okay. All right. Next up, we have Emily, which is the story of Emily Blunt. Is that right?
That is incorrect.
Hell's Bells.
Is she in Paris?
That is incorrect. She is not in Paris, although she does go to Brussels at one point.
Emily in Brussels.
Emily à Paris. No, but she does look a bit like Emily Blunt. It is Emma Mackey playing Emily Bronte. And this is a sort of biopic of the author of Wuthering Heights.
Tells the story. Kate Bush song.
The Kate Bush song. That's exactly right, Chris. Well done. This tells the story of her and her equally gifted sisters. I'm going to leave that to the English grads to argue about. But Charlotte Bronte is played by Alexandra Dowling and Anne Bronte played by Amelia Gething. And they're all living at home with their vicar father, who's played by Adrian Dunbar. And It's a story about partly about them kind of growing up, finding their voices, moving on from sort of telling each other little stories as kids to actually becoming the authors that they would become. But also, it's about a completely fictitious and invented, as far as we know, love story between the parish curate, played by Oliver Jackson Cohen, and Emily Bronte. So it's a little bit annoying to me. So the director of this is Frances O'Connor, who you probably know as an actress. She was in AI. Mm-hmm. She was in Mansfield Park. And I think for especially for a debutante writer-director, I think she's done a fantastic job here of getting, you know, the feeling of the moors, the sense of place, the sense of time, the sense of this kind of very, very bright, rambunctious family who are kind of struggling with the limitations placed on women at the time, but also like kind of pushing against those limits. I think she's got all of that brilliantly. And I think she tells a good love story. Mm-hmm. But I just object to the idea that every well-known spinster in British literary history must be given a tragic love story in their past to explain how they were able to write about love stories. Because, you know, I don't think it's always necessary. And
have
I feel
you tried
like,
acting, dear boy?
Well, a little bit like that. Have you tried imagining how a love story might go based on everything you see in the world around you?
Yeah, that's a very literal take on writers that they must experience.
Literally literal.
And yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think, you know, so much of this is so good that I was kind of frustrated by this. Very well played. I have no problem with the actors, and actually not a huge problem with the scripting of the love story. It's a sort of classic kind of butting heads to finding a connection kind of trope. But it's very been there, seen that. You know, it is. A love story by the numbers, and it kind of feels like, you know, a development exec somewhere has gone, it's great to do a Bronte story, they have great name recognition, but we need a romance in there to make this work. And it just feels like it's doing everybody a disservice, because so much of the rest of this film I thought was really beautifully done.
But Emma Mackey is fabulous.
She is fabulous. I hadn't watched her particularly before.
Sex Education is wonderful.
But she is absolutely fantastic in this, much better than she was in Death on the Nile.
Hey, you take that back about that film. I love that film.
I like that film. She's fine.
I will
but
never hear
she's
a word said against that film apart from all the words I said against that film 45 minutes ago.
But like, I liked her in that, but I love her in this. I think she's really, really talented.
I don't believe in the second Poirot movie because I'm a nihilist. Because it's
nihilism is my least favorite philosophical
movie. It's also Fraser Crane's least. Yeah. No, that's Niles.
Niles.
Anyway, we gave this 2 stars, which I think is a little harsh. I'd probably go 3, but you know, I absolutely understand where we're coming from with
so,
that.
So not so much Wuthering Heights, more Wuthering Shites.
It's really harsh.
It's good. It's good.
Boom, boom, boom.
Wuthering Heights? No, I don't know.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't brontosaurus.
Just leave it. Just let it die, man. Let it die.
Well, that fell off a Heathcliff very quickly, didn't it?
Wow.
There you go. You got it.
Okay, so just a couple of films. I mean, Helen, you know, is like the anti-James. Yeah. For every James, there must be an anti-James. Helen,
like a night off too, though.
No, you don't get a night off, no. O'Hara. You have to see all the films, and you've seen 2 more films you want to talk about real quick. One's called Rosaline, the other one's called Nothing Compares.
Yes, Rosaline is the comic retelling of Romeo and Juliet from the point of view of Romeo as ex. Do you remember she's mentioned in Act 1, Fair Rosaline, and then he basically lays eyes on Juliet and he's like, fuck her, I'm all about Juliet now.
Yes.
He's a bit of a dick. And in fairness, this film really gets to grips with that. So Caitlin Dever plays Rosaline, and she's, you know, ambitious by the standards of her era, which is a long time ago, and has dreams which... You know, Romeo, who's played by Kyle Allen from The Map of Tiny Perfect Things.
And from the cast of A Haunting in Venice, it all comes back
all
to Hercule Poirot.
There we go. He kind of doesn't get, but she's willing to overlook it because she's in love, she thinks. Anyway, then he meets Isabella Merced as Juliet and gets rid of old Rosaline. And she is determined to break them up and win him back with the help of Dario, played by Sean Teal, who is a kind of dead ringer for a young Oscar Isaac. And wouldn't you know it, things don't work out quite the way she intended.
What?
I know,
what?
You can't see where this is going. But what I will tell you is this was a lot funnier and faster than I expected. Bradley Whitford plays her dad.
Yes. Oh, he's on board already.
Christopher McDonald plays Juliet's dad.
Hey, come on now.
Young Sherlock himself plays Romeo's dad. Like, it's a packed cast. You've got Minnie Driver in there as well. It's just really, really sharp, witty, and good fun. It's directed by Karen Main, I had a blast watching it, and I really didn't expect much from it.
So. I wanted to see it a lot.
I know.
I was denied.
You were denied. Mm. Well, who can blame them?
Josh from the West Wing, Shooter McGavin, and young Sherlock Holmes together at last.
Yep.
It's all
five
I need.
Stars. Five
yeah,
stars.
I just had an absolute blast with it. I think it's really, really good fun.
Four and stars?
I would personally go very high three, low four, somewhere in there.
Very high three, low four then for Rosaline. Mm. Excellent stuff. And then we have the Sinead O'Connor documentary, Nothing Compares.
Yeah. So this is directed by Catherine Ferguson. And I was really astonished by this because I just have this image in my head of Sinead O'Connor being this iconoclastic, you know, really crazily outspoken, wild person. And this has a lot of footage from back in the day and obviously some voiceover from herself and, you know, people she knew nowadays. And 99% of the time, she comes across as an incredibly reasonable person saying incredibly reasonable things. And all of these people are acting like she is basically just, you know, shot a puppy in the face. You know, so we can have a discussion about like tearing up the photo of the Pope. I get that that shocked people and I get that people were outraged. But, you know, she had an explanation. She had a thought process behind it. And basically nobody was willing to listen to it. And she already had the reputation for being a sort of, you know, outspoken, crazy iconoclast before that for literally saying nothing outrageous at all. So I find this a really interesting rebalancing the scales because as someone who obviously knows some of the songs, but not much more and wasn't really paying attention to her at the time, I'll be honest, because I was young. I just feel like I learned a lot from this. I know it's probably a bit one-sided and there's probably another side of the story at times, but I do think it's a really useful rebalancing of the public opinion of this woman who really was vilified by the press in a way that absolutely seems unfair looking back now.
Yeah, I love how it draws a direct line to the pop stars of today.
Yeah.
Because now they have their platforms, they've got social media, they have all these things that Sinead didn't have back in the day. But as you say, this rebalances the scales very nicely. It's right on time.
Mm. All right. Would you give it?
Four stars, I'd give it.
I'd probably go again high three, but I wouldn't be mad at a four-star review. Right. Yeah.
Nothing compares to four stars, and that's what we're giving, or three, for Nothing Compares. And you would say that that's it for this week's Empire Podcast, but we have one more guest to come. Do you want one more guest, folks?
Yeah.
Why not?
Sorry about giving your film two stars, Oliver Jackson Cohen, but you are a fantastic...
I go three.
Helen would go three. So there you go. If Oliver Jackson Cohen has listened to this podcast and there's every chance that he's not, then that will have eased his pain. And the film wasn't his fault, right? The two stars
absolutely
wasn't his
not.
Fault?
No, it's okay. Really good performances all around.
Really good British actor, Oliver Jackson Cohen. You saw him in things like... The Haunting at Hill House, and recently you saw him and then didn't see him and then saw him again as the Invisible Man in The Invisible Man. And he was great fun as a buffoonish comic relief in Mr. Malcolm's List just a few weeks ago. And now, of course, he is the love interest to Emily in Emily. And so we were very, very happy indeed to send along Ella Kemp to have a chat with Oliver Jackson Cohen last week. And again, I haven't heard this yet, so there may be all kinds of libel that I just won't listen to during the interview. And it'll slip through and get us all sued. So thanks a bunch, Oliver Jackson Cohen. Anyway, here is Oliver Jackson Cohen. And hang on. Can you hear that?
No, I can't hear anything. No. Nothing. No.
Anyway, that's the end of this week's podcast.
Now it's time for Oliver, Oliver, Oliver. Now it's time for Oliver Jackson Cohen.
Enjoy.
You're a monster.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for talking to us
for
the Empire Podcast.
I love your podcast.
Sorry, one more time, a little bit
I love your podcast. Empire Magazine was the first subscription I ever had. And my mum still receives... I think I've still got it.
You? You're looking at me as if I know.
You probably do know.
Sure, probably.
You're like that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we went to your podcast.
How old are you when you first started subscribing
12.
To Empire?
Okay. Yeah, and it was like... Yeah, it was pre-internet, wasn't it? So it was like that was exactly how you found out everything. Yeah. Anyway,
we're honoured.
I'm honoured to be here with you.
What a great full circle moment. Well, we're not here. We can talk about Empire some more later, but we are here to talk about your projects and your films. We're here to talk about Emily.
Yes.
I feel like I want to know how it feels for you having done this film purely because I know that you had or still have quite an affinity for toxic men. Waitman's, he's not perfect.
He's not perfect.
But there's a little bit more love involved there.
Yes.
You know, there's a bit more passion. There's like, there's the odd moment of joy.
Yeah, he's not going to kill her, is he?
I hope not. I really hope not. What was it like for you being able to explore, I don't want to say lightness, but just have a bit more love in your role?
It was really, without sounding like an actor, like it really was joyous. Mm. Like Francis, I worked with Francis O'Connor like 10, 12 years ago. And she said to me, she was like, oh, I'm thinking of writing a script about Emily Bronte. And then 12 years later, she called me up and said, do you remember I told you about this thing? I've written it. And so sent it to me. And it was.
Did you remember?
Yeah, I did. I mean, and it was such a interesting journey. I went to a French school, so had never read, never studied any of the Brontes growing up or anything like that. So to me, it was like I think I'd seen Wuthering Heights. I'd never read the book, and so to me, it was just this sort of like incredible, like deep. And then once I'd read Wuthering Heights and. I just thought it was such a beautiful ode to Emily Bronte's creativity, and it was an incredible script. So I was sort of very happy to kind of come along and play the religious floozy that he is.
I'm pretty sure that's what's on his name tag.
Yeah. Just religious floozy.
In one of the, there's a lot of very sensual scenes in the film, which is quite exciting for a period piece like this, I think. One of the scenes that I thought was the most kind of arresting to watch, you know, one of the, I suppose, intimate scenes between Waitman and Emily, is when they're just speaking French to each other. there's just this whole, like, you know, it's almost table tennis thing of them just going back and forth the whole time. Obviously, you mentioned you went to a French school, but what was it like for you acting in a different language?
It was great. I mean, Emma's French as well. So we actually, we sort of mainly, like, when we're not at work, we mainly sort of talking in French. So It was I think the use of those French lessons in the story, it's such a clever way of kind of deconstructing, but then also putting up all these walls of this language that with all of the kind of the tension between them, and specifically the sort of what they're trying to repress within themselves, having this extra barrier, and then it creates this sort of incredible kind of passionate, tricky, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so, yeah, they were really great fun to shoot. And Frances as well, she doesn't speak French, so she would just watch the monitor.
You could have been
and
saying it was,
we could have been, literally, we could have been saying anything. But she would just watch the monitor and would feel her way through it and then say, there's a moment where it feels like it needs to. So it was kind of incredible. And I think I hope that everyone feels the same way. I think that they're quite powerful, some of those scenes in the movie.
I mean, with the subtitles. Let's just all hope that, you know.
Let's hope the subtitles make their way. Exactly.
Do you have any French directors in mind that you would be quite keen to work with one day? You could do a whole role in French.
Do you know what? I was actually going to do a French movie last year. With a director that Emma had worked with on Eiffel. Mm-hmm. They were doing Three Musketeers, and then because of COVID, I couldn't.
Were you going to be a musketeer?
I wasn't going to be a musketeer. I was going to be the Duke of, I think it was the Duke of Buckingham. So I was going to do my first sort of French role. And it was amazing. It was like Vincent Cassel. I was so excited. And then I couldn't do it. I was in San Francisco, and because of COVID, I couldn't. There was a quarantine, so I couldn't do it. So hopefully, next year I'll do something with someone.
Are there any names that you wanna put out on the Empire Podcast now to manifest
a
French voice coming into your orbit?
I can't actually. I was just having this conversation with someone just like 5 minutes ago, saying I feel like my brain isn't kicking into gear. We had to do some interviews this morning, and that I was asked about actors. like what actors
name had, an actor.
But it genuinely, it was genuinely, it got to the point of like, it was going through my head and I was like, Morgan Freeman. And I was like that. Well, yeah, he's great, but I don't know. It's like, I feel like my brain is not firing at all. So I have to, I'm going to send you an email with a list.
If you think of a name, mid-conversation, just any name, I'll just shout it out. Just interrupt,
any name
doesn't matter.
Will do.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you another question like that. I'm really sorry.
Okay.
Obviously, we have to talk about Emma Mackey, who is unbelievable.
Yeah, she's phenomenal.
Generally, but also in this film as well. I've seen you describe Emily as like a cross between Haunting and Sex Education. I don't know how that makes me feel.
No, I don't think
that. Because of that, I have to ask, obviously, Sex Education adds the odd new character with every season. Mm. And I'm wondering, if you were to be added to a future season, what would your character be?
Well, do you know what? I feel like I'm way too old to be
what?
In that world. So I would have to come in and play like a dad or a
would you be a good
retired
dad?
I don't know, would I? I feel like you say it's like toxic men.
No,
probably
leave
like
them
another
top.
Leave them in the past. Let's move on. Yeah, I'd love to. Do you know what? I just love to work with Emma again. Mm. And that does sound incredibly actory, but you've seen the film and she's phenomenal. I did a film a year and a half ago called The Lost Daughter, and I'm in it for like a minute, but I got to talk with
them. Oh, we know the tank tops.
The tank tops. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just tank tops and dodgy tattoos.
Yeah.
But Olivia Colman was in it, and she's just got this I've never met anyone quite like it. She has this incredible ability to just sort of drop into something and be so present and so and so alive, and then drops out of it and sort of thinks the whole thing's a bit silly. And Emma has the exact same thing. It's like watching her work and working with her, so you just feel so safe, I guess.
Yeah.
So anything with Miss Mackey,
yeah,
sign me up.
I mean, also another thing about Emily and The Lost Daughter, these are incredible female-led projects, both on screen and behind the camera.
Mm.
And your last three films, including Mr. Markham's List, were directed by women.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what kind of difference you notice on set working with a female director.
Well, I've been really lucky because I feel like Maggie, it was her first movie. Then Frances, it was her first movie. And then Emma Holly-Jones, it was her first movie. So I worked with three sort of first-time directors back to back. And it was so interesting. You know, it was just, all of them have been such interesting experiences. I think that there's something quite special about being a part of being able to be a part of someone's first. Because I can't imagine, I remember talking to Maggie about it, like I can't imagine the fear, like how terrifying it must be to write something and then actually have to make it. Like, I feel like we get it with, like, you know, you say yes to a job and then you go, fuck, I actually have to do it now. Sorry, that doesn't answer your question, does it? I've gone off on a tangent.
It does, because I think the reason I ask also is because I think when it comes to female directors, there can be a tendency to either think that it only works for women in these films. I find it quite interesting when you have very good male characters and performances and actors.
Yeah.
Kind of facilitating the story in a way, I think. Mm. That's it. It's just nice, isn't it?
It's dead nice.
It's good, isn't it?
Dead nice.
Do you miss horror? Are you sad when you're not playing a horrible role?
Do I miss horror? The interesting thing is that, like, I feel like I got asked this a lot, and it was, again, it's because of timing, that, like, I did this show, The Haunting of Hill House, because I'd never read anything quite like it. And it really was, at the time, no one sort of cared about it. No one, I don't remember anyone being, and I remember I had agents at the time that have since been let go. But just sort of saying, there's something so special about what they're trying to do. I don't know whether or not this will work, but I feel like it really could. It was about those characters. So in Hill House, it was about Luke Crane, and about, there was just something, it felt like a really important thing personally, without sort of getting to, but it felt like a really important thing to do. And so it just so happened that he existed in this sort of horror genre. And I think that what Mike Flanagan does and has continued to do is he finds this way of sort of you know, wrapping up these messages and within this horror veil. And so, you know, that whole show was about childhood trauma, but he makes it palatable to people. So I don't know necessarily if it's like I've had this like draw to horror, but the same with Invisible Man. You know, it's about gaslighting and it's about what we've done for ages to women, and there was something so interesting about that message. And so it, I guess it became more about wanting to be a part of that story that was being told.
Yeah.
And none of it felt like going for a cheap trick or anything. It felt like there was something kind of substance to it. You know what I mean?
We just want you to be happy. Like,
I know.
You're
do
in.
You know what? My mom said to me, I literally just got back last night from like a 5-month shoot. And before I went off, it's this thing for Amazon. And before I went off, my mom called me and she was like, where are you going? And I went, oh, I'm off to like New York and like Vegas and Arizona. And she was like, are you playing one of your sad boys again?
Your sad boys.
Sad boys. That's apparently what I do, according to my mum. Thanks, Betty.
Mums love to take care of sad boys.
Nah, you met my one.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Empire Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey everyone, it's Chris here. Just jumping in real quick to say that now I've listened to the interview with Oliver Jackson Cohen, and it does indeed seem like there might be a chance that he has listened to this podcast, in which case we're doubly sorry for the 2 stars we gave to Emily, which of course Helen felt was harsh, and I am sorry for the Wuthering Shites joke. We think you're great, and now it's back to the regularly scheduled podcast. Bye! Okay, so that was Oliver Jackson Cohen, and that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by my policeman next week. So did that interview happen?
It has just happened.
Fantastic. Emma Corrin and Michael Grandage, the star and director of My Policeman.
My Policeman.
That's exactly what it is. My Policeman.
Not quite as good as Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse Ronan, but it's my. I like the my.
It's not as good as My Bologna, is it? You know, it's true. Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird Al Yankovic's on the plane.
Yeah. Saoirse Ronan.
They're not here for you, Frank. Weird Al Yankovic's on the plane. Good stuff. Anyway, someone else might be on the podcast next week. I honestly can't remember. So
fantastic.
Good stuff. Do you come here for professionalism? No, he's refused to see films. Honestly.
I'm a conscientious objector. It's
you're a political... bangly bang. Conscientious objector.
I think I might know who else that somebody else might be.
Maybe. We're not announcing that until it's set in stone. So so we shall see what happens. Anyway, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more fun. We'll be joined by... But anyway, until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from my 3 colleagues of such a lethal cunning, Amon Warman.
Peace.
Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo. See, I'm getting into the Halloween spirit. No, not really.
There you go. And I am refusing on principle to say goodbye to James Dyer.
Fair enough. No one knock on my door on Halloween under any circumstances.
What are you doing in there?
Yeah.
What's he building in there?
If you see the house of rocking, don't... Anyway, I don't know. Just leave me alone.
Oh, my God. I'm Arthur Andrew James's.
All right, Garbo.
Yeah. And it's goodbye for me. I'm around the Jameses for Halloween, or as I'm calling it now, prick or treat. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.
Ooh.
Trauma. Trauma. This is good podcasting right here.